Elizabeth Lash Quinn is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are pleased to be in Syracuse, New York, talking about what could sound like, oh, well, this is an American historian and she cares about these things. But you're saying, if I understand you correctly, that what happened in the 60s as the Great Revolution that changed America toward justice, towards equality, towards really big democratic issues, that we didn't get as far as we might have because other things were happening too.
Mm-hmm.
What is right. this therapeutic thing you're talking about? Tell me more about that, because I don't really understand this concept.
Well, that is it's hard to put your finger on, because it was going on all over the country. But many people think of it as the human potential movement, which came out of the 1960s, had its heyday probably in the 70s or so. It was a very short-lived movement. You can probably say that most of its main institutions are gone. The encounter group after the 1980s or so isn't so much a formal institution. However, I think it left its legacy everywhere in American culture in terms of a way of interacting that people have now. You see it on some radio talk shows.
Mm-hmm.
You see it on some TV talk shows.
You mean the stuff that you go bleed in public?
Yeah, very much, yeah. Where you bear all emotion. And the idea is that if you do that, that's the only road to recovery. And if you do not do that, if you don't go along with that, you are in denial of whatever it is, the problem of the day.
So if my goal is recovery instead of justice,
yes,
I have a different society?
Yeah, I think so. And if recovery really was going to appear, if it really ever was gelling, maybe I could reconsider whether it's such a problem. But recovery never seems to come about. It seems that instead the recovery philosophy, if we really adopt that as a mode for thinking about the world, we don't get anywhere.
I'm sort of mystified about how this could happen. I assume somewhere in this you've probably talked to some of your colleagues in the psychology department and ask them what was going on. But, you know, to read your book and to take it as, you know, to treat it as well-researched, assuming that what you say is a relatively accurate representation of what was going on, it's somewhere between bizarre and appalling.
Yes.
And the way you describe it, it is a broadly pervasive set of conditions relating specifically to civil rights, but also more broadly to the entire culture. And if what you describe is an accurate representation, and it is more than just a little footnote or a little small group of people, it's cause for concern.
Yes, I think it's cause for grave concern, and I think it's affected all aspects of life. It's transforming, I think, intimacy as we know it. It's transforming education and religion.
Can we step through that?
Sure.
Let me give the predicate. Your book, which you call Race Expert, says how racial etiquette, sensitivity training, and New Age therapy hijacked the civil rights revolution. And you're
yes.
saying that this hijack went in lots of different directions. Including, as Bill asks, what's it doing in education?
Well, to start with, intimacy is, that seems like a sort of personal thing. So what's wrong with doing it, being more personal about, and, not all of us do it perfectly, so.
Mm. Yeah, well, this is getting a little bit afar, perhaps, from this book, but.
That's okay.
But I think we can certainly see how the culture of therapy, which I'm trying to describe has changed what we consider private and what we consider public. Because the assumption here is that the more personal your expression, the more you let your identity show to the rest of the world, the identity as it's conceived of in this culture of therapy, the better off you will be, and the more self-growth you will have. It's all about personal growth. And that assumes that there really does not need to be a boundary between the private and the public sphere. And I think that's very damaging to intimacy, and there's some wonderful books about that. For instance, Jeffrey Rosen wrote a book about the decline of privacy, and Rochelle Gerstein wrote a wonderful book about the repeal of reticence. And what they're saying is that there are certain values or certain ways of behaving that protect the private sphere and are needed for the private sphere to flourish, that without a distinction between private and public, we will not have a rich, intimate sphere. And by the same token, just to finish, the public sphere is diminished by bringing everything from the private world to the public world.
There are a lot of things I don't want to know.
Yeah.
Well, and you're describing the reality.
But let me also, it would be, I might be one of those people who feel like I'm a better human by virtue of telling the whole world more than they want to know about me.
You might not.
That's also possible. Your objection in this area and across the board, as it applies to education, as it applies to civil rights struggle, is I think less that, though I'm not sure. This is really a question.
Okay.
Really, honest. But that it, you know, what it promises and what it delivers are not the same. And in fact, I think core objection is that it's not delivering what is promised, and indeed, as you put it, it's always over the horizon.
Yes, and I think what was what we sought with the early civil rights movement, the part I thought was revolutionary, was a complete transformation in American democracy, a realization of the best of the ideals that the founders had, the founders of the country, and that subsequent generations of reformers had, and that the civil rights activists who put their lives on the line for African-American rights, many of whom, black and white, lost their lives in the cause, that the kinds of things they were fighting for were not the kinds of things that the later, some call it the later part of the civil rights movement. I would say it's a completely different movement when the concerns became more about identity and expressing identity, showing identity in the black, in the shift toward black power or black liberation of the late 60s and beyond.
Well, and we talked earlier about King's death, assassination,
yes.
and about that sort of pivotal event, but what that it seemed to coincide with an ascendancy of a group of people who had been there all along, mm-hmm. but who were in varying degrees radically black oriented. That is to say, they were not interested in having white people around.
That's right.
Now there are various variations on that, and that out of that came, you know, what. I mean, a logical consequence of that is black identity, since that is what the focus is. And the argument is that that's, given the history, that's the only way that we can develop and become equal and men.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not much about women, but that's another story.
Or is that another story? Is this in fact driven by that male-dominated, Afrocentric, if you will? Which is not to say it's wrong, but didn't that head us off in another direction?
Yeah, I think that was a mistake too. And that was a mistake, as we've seen from other history books, of the left in the 1960s more broadly, that there be, as the decade wore on, there became a kind of male, a cult of the male in a sense, and I haven't really explored, I've thought some about that, but I haven't really explored and researched it. But my sense is that part of what happened was that some of the reform groups that started out in the early 60s became surprised at how prominent they became. They had no way of knowing that they were going to become a nationally known organization or individual. And I think there was a little bit of a vying for power.
They stumbled into the limelight?
Yeah, yeah.
You're talking about SNCC and Stokely Carmichael, mm-hmm. and people that we came later to associate with black power.
Right.
Part of this seems like, and I guess I sort of feel like I'm jumping around, but I really am trying to puzzle out how this all could happen, It looks like we stopped paying attention, that there was a security. I mean, you mentioned earlier there were other things going on. Vietnam was obviously a big piece of that. There were Watergate interjected in itself, which had, I think, a significant negative effect on the general, particularly our generation's the baby boom attitude about government and power and authority and about the political system.
You have a whole litany of things that are changing in the 60s. And I mean, just that in itself seemed revolutionary.
Some of this stuff, as you say, they stumbled into the limelight. By and large, these don't seem to be particularly good ideas, but it appears that nothing else was going on, that the whole process had been abandoned. And, of course, the Republican Party was in power for a good part of that time and was less aggressive in pursuing what we generally think of as civil rights. But it seems like there's a vacuum, and that's hard. I don't understand it. Mm-hmm. You know, how we could have come that far and then just sort of stopped. And Taylor Branch's word is the Republican Party in 1968 turned on a dime and became something radically different.
Right.
So what happened?
What happened?
Yeah. All of those are very important pieces of the puzzle, and I think there were so many other things that happened to take the civil rights movement off its course. However, I think that one thing you said was, in a way, wasn't it logical to change the focus to identity? That if blacks were going to look at their own neighborhoods and build those up, that they would adopt the terms of identity. And I think that looks inevitable to us looking back because we know how it went. We know how the story went. It did shift toward identity. But it didn't have to do that. And it's funny, the other night I saw James Meredith, who was one of the very bold souls who put
Open University of Mississippi, didn't
yeah, Ole Miss, uh-huh. put his life on the line in the early 60s to integrate, be the first to integrate Ole Miss, a segregated institution, which they had to do forcibly, you know, with many armed people there. And it was very revealing when he was asked one question from the floor about why, when he was such a major figure in the civil rights movement, was the audience at this event where he was speaking almost all white and just a very few black people in the audience. He said, "I'm not surprised. The battle is not over, and the battle was about citizenship, and people forget that." And he said that it's strange because there's something along the lines of there's a lot of place for the civil rights movement in American discourse now, but there's never been a place for James Meredith. And he's full of humor. He's very humble. But that's interesting that he has not been able really to be pegged. And my sense is that's probably because he was part of that earlier movement with this expansive, really revolutionary concept of citizenship and with this idea that the civil rights movement couldn't just change the situation for blacks in this country, but could permanently make this a more democratic nation and could make citizenship something more valued by all of us, something richer, something more interesting, something more engaging. And instead, the sort of inward turn of the identity movement took people away from that rich vision of citizenship and it's kind of a nihilistic turn, a hopelessness, I think.
Let's come back and maybe we can be a little more hopeful with Elizabeth Lash Quinn. She is our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I have joined her in Syracuse, New York. Stay with us. We'll be right back.